These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled The Great Ideas of Philosophy, Part 3. Lecture 25, Francis Bacon and the Authority of Experience.
As something of a prelude to today's lecture, I want to say a few words about experimentation and experiments. Actually, an experiment is not just a form of play. It's not a kind of idle activity to be engaged in by people who have no good ideas at all, but somehow want to keep their hands busy. It's very, very difficult today to find a college or university where all sorts of experiments are being performed, sometimes very much to the detriment of innocent and non-consenting animals. All sorts of undergraduate hours are being consumed by rummaging around dark rooms and answering questions and conducting polls. And there's a tendency to think that because this somehow follows a kind of template or model that is also used in the higher reaches of experimental science, what's going on is good training in science. So I do want to, as a preface to today's lecture, emphasize that all the good thinking is supposed to take place actually before one goes into the laboratory, and then the laboratory becomes the place in which you finally settle on one of a large number of alternatives, all of them seeming to be equally plausible before the research, and now you want to see what the findings actually favor. Experimental science is not a form of mucking about, and I would say, well, this is an estimate, maybe about 95% of what goes on today under the heading of experimental science would bear the very, very heavy burden of proving that it is not merely mucking about. Well, in any case, let me get into the details of the lecture itself. When the writers of the 18th century Enlightenment reflected on the century preceding their own and judged it to be the dawn of the new and great age of science, the great age of Isaac Newton, Newton being a veritable icon in the mind of 18th century Enlightenment philosophers, it was quite customary for Newton's name to be joined to the name of Francis Bacon. In fact, we hear repeatedly in 18th century treatises of the methods of, quote, Bacon and Newton, of the science of Bacon and Newton. And by many lights, Francis Bacon was the prophet, so to speak, whose prophecies would be redeemed in the extraordinary achievements of Isaac Newton. With Francis Bacon, right at the beginning of the 17th century, the world of thought is introduced to what Bacon himself will come to call a great instauration, a novum organum, a new method. And you can just feel in the very prose itself the thought of a man who understands that the antique world is being seen now in the rearview mirror, that progress is in front of us, and that all we have to do is get the method right. We have to disabuse ourselves of the reassuring ignorances of the antique past and get ourselves ready for a new and prosperous voyage whose maps will be set by the senses themselves and by reason pulling together the facts of sense, the data of science, in ever more coherent wholes and ever more general propositions. As he says in his preface to the Novum Organum, a quote from Bacon, quote, "Those who have taken upon them to lay down the law of nature as a thing already searched out and understood have therein done philosophy and the sciences great injury. For as they have been successful in inducing belief, so they have effectively quenched and stopped inquiry and have done more harm by spoiling and putting an end to other men's efforts than good by their own." Now let me pause here for a moment and point out what Bacon is opposing here is the heavy weight of mere traditional thought. It's not a rejection of all forms of authority. It's a rejection of the proposition that because an idea has been around a long time, it somehow has proved itself. Bacon is one of the wonderfully accomplished and complex figures of the Elizabethan age. His dates are 1561 to 1626. He will hold various positions, the most influential being as Lord Chancellor of the realm. His Elements of the Common Laws of England, which appeared in 1630, stand as great literature and stand also as informing jurisprudence. We would surely applaud this sentence from that work: "Laws are made to guard the rights of the people, not to feed lawyers," close quote. His uncle, Lord Burghley, was the Queen's treasurer and powerfully influential at court. Francis Bacon never succeeded in repeated attempts to exploit the influence his uncle had, but he did try. He was a man of great ambition, but with talents that give ambition a good name. He was also in something of a lifelong intellectual and personal struggle with Sir Edward Coke, one of the great fathers of the British common law tradition. Not only did Coke win appointments that Bacon had sought for himself, but he also had won the hand in marriage of the woman that Bacon had hoped to marry himself. So you see, it looks like Lord Coke had Bacon coming and going in these matters. Bacon, alas, had to resign from the bench on the basis of a charge perhaps correct, I don't want to get into that, though it scarcely would have focused on Bacon in any singular way. The charge was that he had accepted a bribe. He was in this the victim of a political plot, for at the time there were those who had their own reasons for undermining the authority of Francis Bacon. Again, I'm in no position to broker the actual facts of the case. Bribery within Elizabethan courts was not a rare phenomenon. It's also worth noting that Bacon is one of the great stylists in the English language. There is more than one Shakespeare scholar still convinced that it was the Earl of Oxford who wrote all of the plays of Shakespeare. And I should say, when I was a boy, the controversial theory then was that Shakespeare's plays were written by Francis Bacon. Now, he does, of course, have a magnificent style. He's the very soul of wit. He can turn a phrase like no one else, except Shakespeare. But Bacon would not have had to write any of Shakespeare's plays to go down in history as one of the great essayists, one of the great moral and juridical essayists ever to write in the English language. If I might pause for a moment to answer the question, to the extent that it's a burning question, as to who it was who wrote the plays of William Shakespeare, the correct answer is William Shakespeare. Now, all this is apart from Bacon's pivotal role in the emergence of the modern scientific worldview. And just a word about the first Queen Elizabeth and the age that bears her name. This Elizabethan period is an expansionist, prospering period. The Queen is an expert Latinist who can do a man's job better than any man, a person of invincible resolve, a patroness of art and letters, of explorers and scientists. She wants her reign to produce something special and singular in the world. She is judged by the poets of the time as the fairy queen. She is Astraea. There's something quite magical about her. As a result of her reign, things will be done that have never been done before. This is the general framework, the ethos, in which an intelligence such as Bacon's will set itself to the task of contributing to the new, enlarging the possibilities yet even further. And most importantly of all, dragging the human imagination, kicking and screaming, away from the secure moorings of the old Greek, the old Latin, and even the allegedly new Renaissance. Well, if the Renaissance is an age of transition, the age of Elizabeth is an age that understands itself, and it sees itself largely in futuristic and evolutionary terms. This is an age looking toward tomorrow and not being distracted by the celebrated achievements of the past. As Bacon will declare, quote, "It is an unsound fancy and self-contradictory to think that things that have never been done will be done except by a method that has never been tried, close quote. Now, many have attributed this spirit of innovation to the Reformation itself, but there is too much evidence weighing against so easy an explanation for so complex a development. Recall that one of the principal outcomes of the Reformation was a counter-reformation, which itself could claim a share in this new energy, this spirit of progress. Moreover, whole sects of those now calling themselves Protestants were inclined to turn away from modernity in all its forms, seeking instead to recover the simple faith thought to have guided the early Christians. If a successful war had been waged on the past during the half century commencing with Luther's 39 Articles, it was a war on the authority of the past. And if there was to be a clear victor in this war, it would come to be the authority of experience. Now, what is this method of Bacon's that has never been tried before? Bacon here wants to set down nothing less than the methods of invention, the methods of discovery, the means by which secure and certain knowledge can be gained. The problem of knowledge is going to be answered in a word. If you wish a guide in the search for knowledge, let that guide be experience. Choose the light of experience, not the authority of texts. I might pause here to say, again, reflecting on the Reformation and Counter-Reformation, one of the constructive consequences of this war of words, and sometimes of more than words, each side charging the other with a commitment, a penchant for superstition, attacks on the good old church for its attachment to the mystical and the mysterious, the good old church responding to the protesters with a kind of rationalism that was hyper-rationalism. I say out of this came something of a modesty on both sides, a kind of haltingness with respect to claims. Out of this came a renewed commitment to get things right. And the Baconian achievement, I think, should be seen as something of a consequence of that movement of thought, that movement of perspective. Now, what about Aristotle? Aristotle was a genius, and he needs no defense. But think of Aristotle's achievements as a kind of water level. This is Bacon's point. If all you do is stay with the wisdom of Aristotle, knowledge will never rise higher than where it was when he left off. So Bacon is not setting out to disparage, but to move on from Aristotle and the ancient world, or what he takes to be the ancient world. His position is progress. There's an impatience about it and an elegance about it. The Novum Organum, the new method, proclaims the epistemological authority of experimental science. That's what's new about it. Notwithstanding Roger Bacon and the Oxford experimental movement, Francis Bacon really does have a more modern conception of the nature and promise of a developed experimental science. What it requires is a set of disciplined and systematic observations, all of these compiled and stored in what Bacon calls the table of discovery. Now, the initial experiments, Bacon tells us, are of two types. One, he says, in the form of experimenta lucifera. These are the light-shedding experiments. They shed light in that they uncover what is actually in the world. These experiments are just systematic studies of the influence of A on B, the routine, mechanical, causal relationships that one observes between events in the external world. These are entered into the table of discovery. Now, he says the nice thing about this kind of experimental work, which some of you might regard as a kind of busy work, the nice thing about this kind of experimental work is it never fails. If all we set out to do is determine the influence of A on B, and we set up the conditions properly, we will know the effects of A on B without any need of philosophical subtlety or metaphysical speculation. What is accomplished this way never gets undone. Facts are facts. Now, whenever we learn of the causal connections in the natural world, we have made progress. We should look for those connections everywhere and without prior censorship. So Bacon says this, quote, "And as for things that are mean and sordid, whatever deserves to exist deserves to be known," close quote. And I pause again here. No realm of potential inquiry is ruled out a priori. No such thing as "we have no business looking into that." And as for things that are mean and sordid, he says, whatever deserves to exist deserves to be studied, deserves to be understood. So Bacon here urges a hands-off policy when an honest laborer sets out on a voyage of discovery. If an entire new world has been found by a kind of inadvertence, who can say when and where serendipity might again yield gold? You see, Columbus has already made this voyage. There are then no taboos. Take off your gloves, roll up your sleeves, get down into that swampy complexity of reality, and create order where initially you found only a mess. And you do this by turning on the lights and finding out what's there to be dealt with. The what there is what the experimenta lucifera are all about. Ah. Now here we have what latter-day critics would come to dismiss as, and this is a phrase you can find in books today, contemporary works, mere Baconian fact-gathering. And indeed, if experimenta lucifera were the only sorts of experiments that Bacon proposed, we would say that he was as tedious and dull as any number of contemporary scientists I referred to at the beginning of lecture, seem to be engaged in nothing but a kind of Baconian fact-gathering. In psychology, if I might repeat myself, this has reached epidemic proportions, and not only lately. One of the great 20th century psychologists, I'm thinking of Donald Hebb, now deceased. He used to have a phrase, I think I've got this right. One of his students told me that he used to speak often of what he called, quote, porcupine research. Now, what did Hebb mean by porcupine research? Well, he meant this. Well, we've done this study, and we found this relationship in the rat, and in the cat, and in the dog, and in the pigeon, and we found it in the goldfish, and the rhesus monkey. And now we're going to undertake a series of studies to see if we can find it in the porcupine. So you get the picture. And that's what one would mean by the most arid form of Baconian fact-gathering. But Bacon knew better and proposed as much in the form of what he called the experimenta fructifera, the experiments that bear fruit. Well, unfortunately, Bacon's efforts here are uninspired for the most part. His own candidates as fruit-bearing experiments are unconvincing and indeed somewhat prosaic. His reputation would only have suffered had it rested on the profit to be gleaned from the sorts of studies he recommends under the heading, the rather grand heading, experimenta fructifera. In these respects, we can agree that in important respects, Bacon may have been Newton's prophet, but he assuredly was not Newton, nor Galileo. Bacon's part in the history of modern science is as one laying out the field, the boundary conditions, the architectonics, the compelling defense of experimental inquiry. And if he failed himself as an originator of specific light and fruit-bearing research, he surely succeeded preeminently in instilling confidence that such was possible. In his concept of experimenta fructifera, he was indeed prophetic. Now, before leaving this part of the Novum Organum, a word more is in order about Bacon's sense of the experimenta fructifera, which anticipates important developments in philosophy of science. There are, he claims, certain experiments that actually allow a choice between competing theoretical possibilities. These are experiments which, conducted in certain ways, actually lead to the falsification of one of two alternative possibilities. And in this, Bacon offers a hint of what in the 20th century will be Karl Popper's famous falsificationist criterion with which to assess scientific theories. It was Popper who made clear that if what we take to be a scientific understanding is the possession of a universal law, then no number of confirmations will ever confirm a universal law, because a universal law refers to an infinite number of possible outcomes. And, life being short, we will never be able to confirm all of them. So instead of verification as an essential feature in the logic of science, falsification is proposed instead. No number of positive instances will ever confirm a universal law, but one or a few instances of falsification should be enough to defeat it. Now, the spirit, but not the letter, of this Popperian understanding is conveyed by Bacon's characterization of the experimenta fructifera. There is something else we find in the Novum Organum. Of course, he says, "And as for things that are mean and sordid, whatever deserves to exist deserves to be known. But there are other things that are not only mean and sordid, they're absolutely sublime. The human understanding is a case in point. Science has no reason to stop short of an examination of the mental life of the scientist himself. In fact, mental life in general. What we need is a special science. Bacon calls it the philosophy of humanity, so to speak, and what today we might be inclined to call psychology, though I think Bacon's aspirations for this are rather greater than what we find today. Now, what we want is a science that is brought to bear on the actual operations of the mind. And this science, like science in general, will have these two experimental components, the experimenta lucifera, where we set about to establish the factual operations of the mind. Now, we're going to see much of this being picked up and carried forward by John Locke, and the experimenta fructifera, which are, alas, not clearly spelled out in this part of Bacon's program. But he does understand that there are observations that will tell for or against a particular theory regarding human nature itself. I want to pause again to underscore the fact that Bacon here is at once ahead of his time and also ahead of himself. It would be wrong to think that what Bacon is considering is what will surface in the first experimental psychology laboratories in Leipzig, or the work of Wundt or Fechner, etc., etc. This is a conceptual framework he's advancing. He's saying we are in a position to inquire in ways that have not been practiced before, and I promise good things will come out of this. He's not a prophet as to just what will come out of it. And as for the methods themselves, nobody could go into an experimental physics laboratory today with no more than Bacon's Novum Organum and know how to proceed. But perspective counts for much. It is one of the great ideas in philosophy, after all, that he is developing. Now, in connection with his advocacy of a science of humanity, Bacon recognizes the biological aspect of human beings as biological entities and the obvious connection between the operations of the mind and the operations of the body. So one branch of the science of humanity, on his account, is to be patterned on the model of the Hippocratic physicians. That is to say, Bacon already is recognizing in the first half of the 17th century that a systematic and scientific psychology is to some extent going to be a physiological or medical psychology. It's going to be indeed a medical psychology. But man manifests himself not merely as a biological or medical entity, an entity best characterized as healthy or diseased. Man manifests himself and his humanity most fully in society, in his political and civic life, in his interpersonal relations. Now, this is a central figure in the Elizabethan age speaking. Man in all of his various forms and activities of life gives you a creature that can never be bottled up in terms of his internal biology, but can only be understood under the light of history, civics, politics, law. This is Elizabethan England and one of its greatest figures speaking. Well, who's the model here? The model here is not Hippocrates. The model here, and so much for the notion that Bacon spends most of his time dismissing Aristotle, the model here is Aristotle. What Bacon finds in Aristotle is a studious appreciation of the fact that a developed psychology is at once politics, ethics, moral thought, biology, early child development, law. So we have this two-branched philosophy of humanity, one in the Hippocratic tradition that is entirely naturalistic, biological, clinical, and medical, and one in the naturalistic political tradition of Aristotle, man in society understood as a participant and indeed as a recipient in a series of interpersonal influences of a social and moral nature. So that there must be the study of man in the particular and the study of man in the aggregate. Now, man in the aggregate is the subject of a future science that Bacon never names. But clearly what he has in mind is what will emerge as sociology. Bacon contends in this regard that man in the aggregate, like man in the particulate, is very much a product of experience. The primary mode of knowing is sensory and perceptual and observational. And on the basis of what we know, we come to be the kinds of beings that we are. Therefore, it is entirely likely that the nature of humanity is going to reflect local conditions in which it has been shaped and the social kilns in which it has been forged. This point, Bacon may appear to be a garden variety behaviorist here, but he is far from indifferent to hereditary factors. He doesn't dilate on these, but it's quite clear that he is not a radical environmentalist. He knows enough about animal husbandry to know that the environment can do much, but it can't do all. So built into his rather progressive, optimistic Novum Organum is a realistic understanding of the limits on even what science can explain and bring about. Now, lest we place too great a stress on the Novum Organum, we must recall that science was going on apace in the ancient Greek world. Certainly, the Hippocratics were aware of, they had systematic observations, and these were favorably referred to by Bacon himself. By the 2nd century AD, Galen provided ample evidence of a deep, sophisticated scientific understanding of how an experiment is supposed to be conducted. Galen's record of surgical studies is a prolific one, if grimly unkind to the creatures that he did study. His biological discoveries rendered him an authority in medicine for centuries, well into the Renaissance. People are still referring to Galen. So it's just a reminder that when Francis Bacon talks about a novum organum, a new method, he's not referring to something new to the world. He's referring to something new now to be given as a tradition to be relied on throughout the years to come, as we see in the scholastic period and in the natural magic of the Renaissance. There was not this confidence in the right kind of method, or even a clarity as to what the right kind of method would be. Bacon is sharpening the focus. We should hear Bacon as saying something like this. Look, Aristotle had the right idea, but we've got to get further than Aristotle. And when he urges the development of a science of humanity, it should be no surprise that he reaches back to Hippocrates and Aristotle. So the complaint is not with the ancient world. The complaint is what has interceded between the good start that the ancient world made and then what Western intellectual history did with it, which was pretty much replace it with a collection of orthodoxies, ultra-rationalistic, scholastic, logic-chopping, analytical devices that found us falling in love with words. He says in one of the famous passages that this is like falling in love with a picture. Words are simply representative of things in the external world. For goodness sake, if you're interested in the external world, go into that world. Don't sit around talking about it the way a lover falls in love with a picture. So progress requires the right kind of method. The right kind of method was known to antiquity. The intervening centuries have allowed us to impose a kind of official blindness on ourselves, an ignorance on ourselves by way of orthodoxies. What we now have to do is come to grips with the secular dimensions of knowledge and the secular dimensions of progress. That all this would spawn yet other orthodoxies seems not to have worried Bacon as much as it might have.